Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday evening, September 15th, 2010, and is now 7:01 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Send us your email anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. I would also like to mention that Liberty Talk Radio is now available via iTunes on our archives. You can get our archives via iTunes now, so please tune in whenever you like. Lastly, I would like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. This evening we have, when we're very pleased to have as a return guest, Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We'll be talking about the economy. Does the economy suck? And let's get Andy on the wire now and let's see what he has to say about that. Good evening. Is that you, Andy?
It is, Joe. How are you?
Fine, fine. It's so great to hear your voice. It really is.
It's great to hear yours, too. You're one of the few places that I can go to get a little bit of sanity these days.
You know, I'm serious. I was thinking the same thing. I said, I have to tell you what I just heard on Fox TV. I was doing this while folding laundry, by the way. I promised my wife I would fold the laundry before she got home, and I just about made it. But I was listening to this one gal. They were talking about a subject that had to do with a person having the right of free speech. And I don't know what they were talking about because I just came in for 2 seconds at the very end, and they were talking about, well, she says, he has the right, the Constitution gives the people the right, gives the right. We have the right to free speech, but you know, you don't get persecuted for free speech. She said, but the Constitution does not protect anyone from making others feel badly about it. And I stood there and I said, you mean, and there was no one in the studio who got up and said, excuse me, let me cart this woman off? I mean, and everyone just stood there and sort of nodded their heads. And I said, now I know I am losing my mind because no one in their right mind would say something so stupid, especially on something on Fox News. Doesn't protect.
You know, let me tell you something. The media, you know, this is really kind of ties into the whole political, economic, social fabric and spectrum. The media coverage today really reminds me of what you used to see. And you know, I'm going to use a harsh term here. A place called Soviet Russia. Yeah. With the way the media is just spinning these stories, I've got a funny one for you too here before we really get rolling. I was reading an article here on I think it was ABC's website, and it was talking about a topic over with Kim Jong Il and him being sick and all this other stuff, and they actually threw out a barb and accused the state media over in North Korea of spinning news stories and fabricating media coverage. And I'm thinking to myself, you have got to be kidding me.
You know, I went to visit a very elderly, not very elderly gentleman, in his 90s. He's a dear old friend of ours, and he's in a assisted living home. Pretty well-to-do, and this assisted living place is really beautiful, but he can't walk or anything like that. And I visit him probably three times a month, and I spent an hour or so with him. And we talk about these items, and I mentioned to him, we talk about the economy a lot, because he used to be a stockbroker, investment counselor, back in the old days. And I said, I do not give the economy any chance of ever truly recovering. Ever. I don't give even 1% anymore. I don't even say it's most likely. I say it is impossible to recover. When you think that in 2009, the entire federal income revenues were absorbed by entitlement programs alone. I mean, just think of that. And then that left them with nothing after that. And yet we have a war that we claim cost about $500 to $600 billion on the books, but over $1 trillion on and off the books a year, which we don't seem to even count. And it can go on and on and on. And you say, well, how could this ever take place? How could we ever recover? When we drive, I think I'm becoming a lunatic, by the way, Andy. I really mean it. I spoke
you and
to
me
a
both.
I said, I think I am just losing my mind. I'm going to be one of those people who walk the streets and is talking to themselves and, you know, blah, 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 blah. I'm going there. You know, we're just driving and we see this field that used to a farm. They used to soybeans and stuff. And this is right down from my house. And now they're plowing it up and they're building, you know, a housing division. Oh, they started to. I think they stopped because there's no one buying anything. But I said, you know, that's an excellent metaphor for our economy. We take something productive like farmland and we convert it to something which requires consumption. I said, there's your metaphor for the entire country right there, that piece of farmland. And it seems
absolutely.
Like
you know, and it even gets better than that. I mean, we've got up in this area, we have this fever pitch of imbeciles that run the local municipalities here. All they want to do is bulldoze productive farmland and other types of assets, bulldoze them under and create consumption centers, otherwise known as malls.
Right.
And they think they're going to create, we're going to create millions of dollars in tax revenue because we're going to have 20 malls within 20 square miles instead of 10 malls. And, you know, they don't understand this idea of saturation, market saturation. Right. It's like, you know, there's only so many dollars that are going to be spent at a mall or a casino or any of these other frivolities of our society today. And just because you put more of them there does not mean that you're going to have more money spent there. People are going to spend about the same amount of money regardless. You're just going to have a dilution across the number of these malls. And you're right, they're tearing down productive assets and they're putting in drains, basically. Yeah. They're drilling holes in the economy where we used to have production.
And to use your example, now that you have 8 stores selling the same thing, you have 9, right? And that means all the other 8 stores are selling less because you're not creating wealth or anything, you're just redistributing.
Yeah,
that means everyone makes less money, so the cost of even selling that particular good or service gets higher, exponential. I mean, much higher by 12%, and then all of a sudden they go out of business. I mean, and then they need government subsidies because they need to stay in business. This becomes a madhouse. I think the only way that we're ever going to truly recover is if everything is allowed to collapse. Truly collapse, and then we rebuild from scratch, and hopefully we will rebuild according to the way we did things 200 years ago. But
I'm going to tell you what, normally, you know, probably maybe even as most recently as a year ago, I would have said, nah, we got a chance. But I tell you what, I must be going insane too. Maybe you and I can start a chain of asylums or something.
An economic asylum.
Yeah. We'll start some asylums. I would have said, hey, I think there's a chance we can pull this thing around. But it seems like the further this thing gets kicked down the road, it seems like the more people continue just to demand it. You know, there's little ripples here and there, and you've got some pockets of people that aren't so interested in the status quo anymore, whether it's politically or economically or otherwise. But for the most part, you've got people just wanting more and more and more of the same. Nobody wants to bite the bullet. Because of that, you're absolutely right. I think the whole thing's going to have to come crashing down around us. And then the ones who were, smart and were able to preserve a little bit, they're going to be the ones that have something left over. They're going to be the ones that hopefully the resourceful folks will be the ones that get the most input into decisions on how these systems are kind of put back together a little bit as we get to the other side.
Yeah. In this town of Tulsa, not anymore. I mean, it's slowed down considerably. But if there was a corner, there would be a strip shopping center in every corner. And you think, well, it's the same stupid stores on every corner. I mean, if the population is not growing at all, or if it is, it's insignificant. So you say, well, how does this affect, you know, the entire economic system here in Tulsa when you have 45 stores selling the same thing rather than 4 or 5? That's all you need, you know. And I could have, I said, this can't continue, and it didn't. Obviously, it came to a screeching halt. And now, whenever I go into a shopping mall, the first thing I do, of course, this is part of my lunatic situation, is that I start counting what I call holes, the number of stores that are closed. And every time I go back, there are more and more. We better take the hint on that.
Yeah, there's, you know, I just read an analyst report today on a restaurant chain called Sonic. I'm sure probably most people know what that is. The analyst actually downgraded the stock. And one of the factors that the analyst stated in making the decision to downgrade that particular stock was the fact that their expense of running their stores has crept up with regards to the amount of revenue they bring in. And bingo, you know, it's like, come on, finally a light bulb went on somewhere?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the exact product of all this dilution that you have going across. You know, there's 10 restaurants on every corner, you know, and there's only 10,000 people. I mean, you know what I mean? It's just, it gets
right
to the point where it's ridiculous.
Right.
Everybody's profit margins go down. And, you know, a lot of these chains, Starbucks, they had to close a whole bunch of stores. You're seeing this all over the place, and we're not getting it. You know, people that might pay attention to, you know, a particular chain, oh, wow, you know, they had to close a bunch of stores. Well, I guess they didn't sell enough mochaccinos or whatever they call that stuff, you know, at that one. But people just, you know, big picture, just aren't getting it. And this is where the news media is just totally absentee. And this is where our news leaders our political leaders, our government leaders are absentee as well. Because nobody is helping put the pieces together for the people. And I think there's a lot of people that really understand what is going on. And now you got Alan Greenspan coming out today. I guess it was, and he's in favor of, he wants more taxes. And, you know, he wants these tax cuts for the middle class to go away because we're just not paying enough taxes to keep this big government cancerous machine going, I guess. Yeah.
You know, my wife and I just the other day sat down, and of course she doesn't bother with the books or the taxes and all this, but we are strategizing on how, you know, how we are going to cut back our business so we don't fall into a trap of a tax bracket that's going to murder us. So now what the government has done to me, it has made me so tax conscious that instead of saying, well, how can we improve? How can we attract more customers? How do we promote this? I'm saying, how do we scale back without hurting the business? I mean, this is exactly what we're doing. I'm
exactly
scaling back.
That sounds like a good recipe for growth, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. I say, now remember, we're not going to make that much money this year. We're scaling back. And the other misnomer, and there must be 1,000 articles out there. I think I read most of them. The increasing consumption does not equate to growing economy. All that does is take money out of people's hands that they should be saving or investing and sending it over to places like China. And yet all the mainstream media talks about is how do we increase, and politicians, how do we increase consumption? And they have the wrong end of the spectrum that they're working on. So it's doomed to failure, absolutely doomed. But what bothers me is that the people listen to this. This is what they do. People listen to damn TV all day long. I very rarely put the stupid thing on. Only do it when I'm folding laundry because I got to stand up in front of something. But that's where they get their education. So when you discuss things with them, they talk about consumption, and it's not there. And it's so difficult to convince them that that's the wrong end of the spectrum.
Well, you know, here I'm going to give CNBC a little bit of credit due here. They actually did post an article, and I put it on my blog this morning. It's called American $6 Trillion Short for Retirement, and it was a study done up at Boston College, and they've got a Center for Retirement Research up there, and they're blaming the stock market decline in housing values, you know, but they don't even quite get it. You know, they don't get the idea that, oh, people should have been saving money. Well, people thought their house was going to provide them with retirement income.
Right.
And, you know, obviously your stock market investments are supposed to, but, you know, they've got half of it wrong. you know, housing values. You know, since when did you buy a house? When in our history have you ever bought a house with the idea that, you know, this house is going to, you know, be the pathway to my retirement? I mean, yeah, you pay it off, and then you don't have, you can burn the mortgage book and,
right,
and have a party and
That's
do
right.
all that kind of stuff. But whoever said, you know, I'm just going to buy this house and I'm going to put next to nothing down on it, and then every couple of years I'm going to do a refi and take cash out so I can keep going on vacations and buying new cars and all this other. I mean, when have we ever done something so stupid?
Yeah, it wasn't until I was almost 50 years old, and I hate to admit this, that a friend of mine told me about a boat he was buying. And in fact, I worked with him. And I said, oh, that's nice. I said, you know, worthless piece of, you know, a boat. But I likes boats. That's nice. And he said, because he accumulated X number of dollars in his 401k. And I said, well, what does the amount of money accumulated in your 401k have to do with buying a boat? I mean, to me, I mean, they were totally mutually exclusive. And nothing, you know, he said, well, what do you mean? I said, what do you mean? What do I mean? What does that have to do with it? Because the way I look at my 401k is the money goes in, it never comes out. I mean, it only comes out in the event of an emergency or necessary, or when you're 90 years old, you got to take it out. But that's my warped way of thinking. And he says, oh, he says, everyone does that. He says, you know, they really use a 401k as a forced savings plan, and then they go out and buy a new car. I looked at him, I said, his name is Monty. I said, oh, nice guy, really nice guy. I said, come on, Monty, you know. And I sat there. He left my office, and I sat there. And I was held financial services at the time for Shell, you know. I'm sitting there. I said, you know, I got to be the most naive person. I mean, totally naive person in the world. So I ran down to the employee relations department, and I said, I have a general question, nothing specific. I don't want anything. You know. I said, do people ever withdraw money from their 401k plan? And I never forget, the gal behind the desk looked at me like I had just lost my mind. She said, she looked at me like, yeah, like, you know, do birds fly? Yeah, they do, you know. I said, yeah, I mean, a lot? She said, yes, all the time. It was like, literally, she was saying, what a stupid question. And I went back and I said, what a jerk I am. I mean, me, I'm under the old paradigm of you save money, but you take that money only when you need it. If you need it, if not, it stays. And, you know, I said, my God, am I in a different world? Now, this is by the way, we have a caller, but they don't. They pressed the one button. I think they have a question. You want to take a caller now, Andy?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Caller, it didn't click. Come on, clicker. Let's click. Caller, you're on the air. Your first name, where you're calling from, please.
Hey, Joe, it's Joe.
Hey, Joe, how are you?
All right. So, you're talking about finances tonight, huh?
Right, and we want to borrow money from you, too.
No problem. What have you got for collateral?
I got some treasury bonds.
My wife. But don't tell her I said that.
No, don't worry, I won't.
By the way, Joe, this is Joe from Montana, is it not?
Yep.
Yeah, you have a blog talk radio program, False Flag. Is that true?
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was trying to listen, and I've got to speak to you later on when we get off the air, because I had difficulty.
Okay.
You know, you got to square me away. I'm so done with these computers. I literally tried to get on the air because I wanted to give you a hard time, but I was trying to listen to your program, okay? But be that as it may, Joe, go ahead. Ask your question. Ask away.
All right. Well, I was just, as I was waiting, I was listening to you, Joe, and you were saying that the wrong end of the spectrum economically is about spending versus savings. I'm going to have to disagree with you on that. You believe savings would be more beneficial than consuming.
Yeah, but let me clarify this. Savings equates to investment. Investment is a thing that initiates productivity, innovation, all that stuff, gets the economy going, increases the standard of living of everyone. And I'm sorry for interrupting, but if you go back 100 years, people were taking money. They weren't going out and shopping. I mean, we never went shopping. We never went out to eat. We never did any. We spent nothing. But you know, my father had a business. I mean, he took money and he saved it and he borrowed from it for his business to expand his business. Now, it doesn't have to be your business. It can be somebody else's business. It's totally immaterial. Who does it? But someone does it. Well, today we're not doing that. And we're saying that once we just spend, someone's got to produce. Someone's got to create. And so we have let me give you a hypothetical situation. Let's assume for a second everybody was a consumer. No one was a producer. Where would you go?
Well, using your scenario, I mean, if nobody was a producer.
I know the silly scenario. I know it's absolutely stupid.
Yeah,
but,
course you get zero.
Yeah, all right, right. So, but what if everybody was a producer in the United States, right?
Right.
But no one was a consumer, right? But there were people all over the world that consumed. In other words, you would become a very, very wealthy nation. People's standard of living would go through the roof. But go ahead, argue with me. Or argue with
Andy. If you're going to be a producer and you're going to be all savings, then you're going to have zero economic growth, too.
No. The savings is investment. The savings
investment, but what makes an economy grow is the fact that they can sell their goods, and they can't sell their goods unless they're consumers.
You can't sell the goods, Joe, unless you produce them. That's my
point.
Well,
that's true, but see, I understand. Yeah, you're right. But at the same time...
Of course I'm right. I'm always right. I've never been wrong in my life.
Always
except
been right.
Once
You've
in
19... Been right.
No, I'll be honest. Back in 1954, I was wrong once in 1954. It was a small error, and I corrected it immediately. But go ahead, Joe.
Let me tell Mr. Sutton, you've always been right. Always. but the thing is that if you have, let's say, a land of producers, okay, and you have all savers but no consumers, they will have money, yes, for investment. Now, let's say you have producers and consumers and no savers. Okay, what happens then? Then what happens is that the consumers will buy the products, but what you would come back with, well, if there's no savings, there's no investment. I would say no, because the banks would go to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve would loan money to the banks, which would loan money to the manufacturers and the wholesalers and the refiners, and they would then get enough money to do their particular phase within the economic.
Joe, let me jump in here a second.
Okay.
Where does the Federal Reserve get the money?
They print it.
Oh, okay. So they can do that at will, right?
Absolutely.
So it's really not worth anything then, is it?
Never has been.
Okay. All right. Well, as long as we agree on that. Basically, what you have here is if you have a production and consumption function, you guys talked about both the extremes. It's a continuum. In any functioning economy, you can't think of it just as America now because everything's global. Production is going to equal consumption except for basically a small amount that's held in inventory, 1%, 1.5%, whatever. So on a given month, a given year, production is going to pretty much equal consumption. Our problem here in America is that we've been consuming and sending our money overseas. We haven't been producing what we consume. So therefore, we're dependent on foreigners for our goods. That's the first part. And then secondly, they lend us the money so that we can buy their goods. So not only don't we produce what we consume, we're dependent on them for goods, we're also dependent on them for financing. So what Joe Cristiano is saying here is what we need to do is we need to kind of reverse that. We need to move towards the other end of the continuum where we actually save and invest in production here in America so we can kind of balance that equation out a little bit. In other words, what we need is a bunch of protectionism, and we're not going to get it because now we have very little leverage.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on some of your elements. The thing is that since China and Japan, they hold over $5 trillion worth of treasury bills. That's one thing. But to say that we don't consume, we produce, anybody who buys anything is a consumer. Now, if we kept the jobs in America, there'd be more people who'd be employed, and they'd be able to spend more money. The thing is, an economy has to roll based upon the selling of its goods, not the production of its goods. If it produces goods and nobody buys them, they go bankrupt, and there's a lot of inventory.
But let me ask you this. How did we do it for 185 years until we decided to start buying from overseas and doing things that way? We did it by producing and consuming our own production.
Yeah.
We became the wealthiest country in the world. by being producers first and consumers second. And it was when we got away from that that all the trouble started.
Right, and exporting all over the world. Any
we exported everywhere.
We exported, right. People did exporters.
People did consume it, but we made it here. We consumed what we needed. We exported the difference, and that built our national wealth. That's how we created the greatest country on the planet, and we ruined it by doing the exact opposite.
Yeah, but that's not the only model. You have Abu Dhabi, you have Dubai, you have Saudi Arabia, which produces nothing but oil, and because they have money, they import everything, just like Japan did. Until it built up its own economic base, and they still became wealthy. It depends upon the balance.
They didn't become wealthy. You look at the average Saudi Arabian or the average person in Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi, they're putting, they're meeting people at the airport with cops now if they try to leave the country because everybody's bankrupt.
That's only because the last two years, because of the debt bubble, which Paulson.
Yes, their whole growth was a bubble. That you hit it exactly.
No. Not their whole growth was a bubble. The last 2 years, when they leveraged the same as everybody here in America and Wall Street over leveraged. Prior to that, they had enough money to take care of their citizens, so that the citizens didn't have to pay for education. They didn't have to pay for hospitals. And the country still had enough money to build an infrastructure.
Yeah, they produced. They produced oil. They produced.
Yeah, they
something.
Sold oil. They
right.
Imported,
yeah, it made,
they
made no difference. Yeah, right.
And they imported bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they had to spend. They had to spend scarce resources to get it out of the ground. They had. You know, obviously, they were gifted with a national asset there, a natural resource in the form
right.
of oil.
It didn't follow our model, did it? Their model was they had one resource. It was oil. They exported it. They got into contracts with American contractors, which went over there and built up the infrastructure, just like Abu Dhabi and Dubai.
You just made my point, though, Joe. Look what we did for 185 years. We didn't have oil, but what we did in place of having that natural gift in the form of oil, what we did is we built a manufacturing base, and that was our asset, just
That's
like
right.
oil is theirs.
That yeah. was the American
just like
asset.
A free...
I mean,
our free market system really was
yeah,
our
we
asset.
Yeah, we agree with
well,
that.
The free market did what the free market did with the natural resources, which was what America was gifted with, besides oil. Abu Dhabi, though, I'm saying, is not the same as our model. It's the opposite of our model. They have.
No, but the problem is it doesn't matter what the model is of how you produce. The point is, if you are a producer first and a consumer second, you're going to have financial and economic success. If you try to be a consumer first and a producer second, you're going to run into trouble. And that doesn't matter if you're producing widgets or oil or natural gas or timber or whatever the case is. It's the mindset. It's the mentality. You cannot borrow and spend your way to prosperity. It's never happened, and it never will.
Right. That has nothing to do with what you were saying before.
Right. Joe, I have to come up to Montana, Joe, and give you a whooping until you say uncle. That's the answer to this. All right, we're going to get off of this, and we're going to break for station identification. Folks, this is Liberty Talk Radio. We have, we're all clinically insane here, so we do accept that you will call in and join this party. Our telephone number is 646-652-4620. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are pleased to have with us today Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He's an economist, and if Joe would only agree with us, we can get on with our program.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, okay. I'll just say it.
And we can get on with our program. We do welcome your call, 646-652-4620. I'd like to get off this subject for a moment, please, because we don't have enough information about Abu Dhabi and all this, and all the intricacies, and I don't want to go there, I'll be honest with you, because we can go round and round and round and round. But basically, we do have a problem here, and the problem is we go shopping. When I was young, we never went shopping, and somehow the family attained wealth. Today, people are shopping and shopping and shopping, and they're all broke. Enough said about that. Well, you know, I have a question. Warren Buffett said this morning that he does not expect, or was it this morning or yesterday morning? Yeah, I guess yesterday, does not expect a double dip. And there are other people saying, you know, well, he's part of the mainstream media, if you will. He's part of the mainstream, so he's always going to say something positive. Andy, do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I think you just nailed it right there. I mean, I think Warren Buffett has become more of a mouthpiece for the status quo, really, than anything else. I used to respect him as a quasi-shrewd investor, but it's obvious that more recently he seems to want to just keep the status quo going and all of that sort of thing. Honestly, you look at these fundamentals, and see, the problem is, Joe, you've got a lot of people on that Keynesian side. They don't understand this. They don't understand the idea of, you know, foregoing of consumption and the resulting savings becoming capital, and that capital being investment, and that becomes, you know, something that generates wealth. They don't understand that. They look at it, not to knock Joe Montana, but from the standpoint of, we'll go to the Fed, the Fed will lend us money, and we'll make the economy grow by the Fed lending money and people spending money, and we'll basically push the economy forward on the debt function instead of on an investment capital-driven function, and that broke this economy, and it's undeniable. You can't deny it. We have history on top of history on top of history in this country of doing the right things and doing the wrong things, and when we do the right things, we do well, and when we do the wrong things, when we get away from it, we don't do well. So, I mean, I'll let the history speak for me. I don't need to defend right. What happened over the past 230 years. I understand what went on. I think Warren Buffett is plugged into the Keynesian system, and he thinks the Fed should, lavish the banks with more money and keep that financial economy going. And nobody really seems to be talking too much about Joe Consumer, Joe Average. You know, he was just kind of the useful idiot that kind of helped prop this thing up for the last 8 or 9 years. And when he's spent out, well, he's spent out. We'll get the government involved and let them spend the money for us because, after all, they know how to do it better.
Right. Well, then that begs the question, which is the question, which is the lead line in on my blog, is, does the economy suck?
It depends who you are.
Okay. Give us a scenario, Andy.
Well, if you're a Wall Street bank, I think the economy is pretty good.
Right, okay.
You made a bunch of bad decisions if you were a Wall Street bank, and you over-leveraged, and you did all these bad things, all this financial malfeasance and misbehavior and shenanigans, and you got made whole for the most part. And, you get to, continue doing what you were doing before, except they're really not. They're just kind of sitting on that money now and holding it at the Fed for interest payments. So, they were made whole for the most part. For that situation, you get to charge a consumer an average, I guess it's around 13.5% if they want to have a credit card now. So if you're a Wall Street bank...
Way more than that.
I said average.
On the average, I would say over 20%.
Go to bankrate.com. The average is about 13.5%.
Well, see, Joe, that's for people like you who haven't made a payment in 6 years.
Oh, please.
but the economy kind of sucks for everybody else, doesn't it, Andy? Or am I missing?
Well, if you're one of those people that's lost a job and you're sitting on unemployment and you're filing applications here and there and maybe getting an interview or two, and people just aren't moving because they're looking to scale back their business like you are to avoid taxes.
Right.
It does. It's not good. So it really depends on what seat you happen to be sitting in.
Right.
If you were one of those people that, saved a lot of money and now has some cash in your hand, and you want to make some expenditures, now is a good time because everything's on sale. So again, it really determines by where you're sitting in this whole thing. And the majority of people are not sitting on Wall Street. They're not sitting in bank boardrooms or anything like that. They're sitting on Main Street, and they're dealing with job losses, the threat of job losses. People are having to take part-time hours instead of full-time. They're having their wages cut, all these types of maladies that they're going through, yet the expenses keep rolling, the bills keep coming in. So for them, it's not good, and I'd say that's probably the majority of people.
Okay. We
don't have a middle class anymore.
Do we
right, we don't.
We have another caller on the line. You want to take that one now?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Okay. Caller, you're on the line, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Good evening, Joe. This is Adam from Atlanta.
Adam from Atlanta. Thank you so much for calling in, Adam. Appreciate it. You have a question for Andy?
My pleasure. Yes, for Mr. Sutton, why do you think the price of gold has remained stagnant over the last 9 months, hovering at around $1,200 an ounce? and I'll be happy to take the answer off the air.
Sure. Well, gold, you've got a situation, and that's something I just expounded upon in our most recent newsletter here. You've had a situation where gold has been obviously a safe haven for inflation. It just didn't make a record high. It had gotten knocked down a little bit. It's been seesawing pretty much for the past 4 or 5 years, really. You know, it'll go up a bit, it'll make inroads, and then it'll get knocked back down. It'll go up, make more inroads, it'll get knocked back down. The problem, I think, with gold is now is you've got a lot of people trading it. People, you know, gold bugs, as they're normally called, are people that invest it, and they see the value in gold as actual money, not printed paper tickets from the U.S. Mint issued by the Federal Reserve. They understand the monetary attributes of gold as being a genuine store of account and store of value and things of that nature. So you've kind of got this battle going on. You've got people that are trying to, you know, turn gold into a momentum casino like the stock market, and then you have other actual investors in gold, and then you have a number of banks who are in the paper market, namely among them J.P. Morgan and HSBC, who like to go short a lot to try to smack the prices down for whatever ends they hope to meet by doing that. So you've got basically a big tug of war here, Adam. And, you know, right now, you know, the investment, the long side is winning, and, you know, we've got another record high here, and that's not to say that it couldn't get smacked down again, and I think it probably will. That's been the pattern here. We make a record high, we get beat down again. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised at all if gold went back down maybe to 1225, 1215, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Now, Andy, I've been an investor in gold mining, or, you know, mining stocks, and some of the gold mining stocks for about 12 years now. And you need an iron stomach to do that. When the economy, the market crashed about a year and a half ago, whenever it was in, 2008, when it just dove down to only, 50% of where it was, or less than that, my mining stocks went down like 60, 65%. I mean, I was almost wiped out. However, today, hello, oh, I think someone left this. Oh, I think Joe just left this. Today, I am further than my highest point ever in those stocks. So you really need an iron stomach for that. But what's happening, I think, in the mining industry is that the amount of, whether it be gold, silver, copper, whatever the mineral is becoming more and more difficult to extract. And the quality is getting is becoming poorer, so it's costing more and more to extract less and less, and eventually, it's just by virtue of the fact that there's going to be more demand as the population grows and as people get weary of their currency, with the supply becoming more restricted. I think you're going to see. Overall, I mean, long term, but believe me, I agree with you. Tomorrow, the gold or silver may tank, and I've seen that 100 times over the past 12 years. You're going to see this upward projection for at least another 10 years until something else happens, and I don't know what that's going to be. What do you think of that, Andy?
Well, I think basically what you have is you had a change in paradigms back in 2000. You had an equity super cycle from 1982 to about the year 2000. And that was an 18-year cycle, and these long cycles are generally 16, 18, or 20 years. And you've had at least 10 years of this commodities
right.
super cycle, and that's silver, gold, and, you know, oil, obviously, some of these other things as well. I expect that to go on probably for a full 20 years, meaning we're only roughly halfway through that. There's something that's out there on the horizon, though, that I think could even exacerbate this cycle and make it even longer, and that's scarcity.
Right.
You know, you're in a situation where, you know, it's getting harder to find this stuff. You know,
right.
it's obvious,
That's
you know,
right.
common sense, I think, when you go out to look for something, you're going to pick the easiest fruit first, the low-hanging stuff.
Right.
And, you know, only after that's gone are you going to get your ladder out and your cherry picker and go up in the tree and, you know, risk life and limb and all this sort of thing right. to get the apples that are at the top of the tree. I mean, that's just common sense.
Right.
And I think the same thing is true when you're talking about procuring, you know, gold, silver, oil, whatever the case may be. Now, what's helping us out, obviously, is technology. I mean, we have technologies for drilling that we didn't have 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's helping us to to put this back a little bit further, but you do have a very real situation here where, you know, it's not just oil. You know, you talk about some of the base metals, some of these rare earth metals. There's just not a lot of this stuff, and we're using it up in a wanton fashion.
That's right.
And in a lot of cases, we're doing it irresponsibly.
Right.
And, you know, you have to start to wonder, what is the sustainability? And that's kind of become my favorite word. You know, when somebody throws something out there, my first thing that crosses my mind now is this sustainable? You know, like you talk about, you know, bailing out banks and doing all this credit and spending and just being little consumers all the time. Is that sustainable? And the answer is no.
Yeah.
You know, I think the same thing is true when you start talking about natural resources, because they're scarce. And, you know, we're using them, we're buying them. You know, in the case of oil, we burn it. So it's not like gold where 95 or 98% of it is still above the surface.
Right.
You know, this, some of these things, you don't get them back.
Right.
And, you know, that to me, you know, speaks volumes about, you know, what we've got to, you know, try to do moving forward to keep this stuff flowing. I mean, you just take a look at oil. You know, years ago, well, we found guar over in Saudi Arabia and Canarel down here in Mexico, and we've been pumping those for years and years and years, and particularly Canarel, it's really starting to drop off, so we're going out and looking for more oil. Well, where are we doing it? We're doing it 7 miles under the ocean in some place.
Right.
You know, we're doing it where the Deepwater Horizon exploded and sank.
Right.
You know, that was a mile
right.
under the ocean. So we're going out, and we're going after the higher fruit.
Right.
You know, not the low-hanging stuff. We're getting out the ladder and the cherry picker, and the problem is, in the case of a lot of these natural resources, is it costs a lot of money
right.
to do this. And, you know, if you're going to see oil at 10 bucks a barrel, somebody's not going to go out and spend 50 to get it. That's just the reality.
Right. Well, you know,
We may be able to procure plenty of this stuff, but, you know, at what cost? You know, that gets thrown into the equation, too.
You know, what people don't recognize, I mean, because it's a slow process, is that it is becoming increasingly more difficult to mine, you know, these resources. The number of people who hold, for example, silver, they say is 1% of 1% of the population. And so, of course, it's a very small population. Well, what if we went from 1% of 1%, you know, we just doubled that, which would be still a very small portion of the population. The silver, all the silver above ground silver would disappear in a day. I mean, this is how critical it is. This is how short supplied we are. But that's because the demand has changed a little bit, but really not much. I mean, we haven't had people saying, geez, in order to be financially stable, you should have this, 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 and plus so many ounces of silver. The day
right,
they start
yeah.
saying that, the ball game's over. And I remember back in the 90s, miners would brag, some miners would brag that they were very efficient, that they could extract gold, for example, at less than $200 an ounce. That's what their cost to extract it was. And now they're lucky to do it at $400 an ounce. I mean, the world has really changed in 10 years, just tremendously. Now, with oil, for example, which is very interesting, what people don't take in consideration is that we are squeezing less and less gallons of gasoline and jet fuel, et cetera, out of every barrel of oil, because the oil is getting less sweet, less good. It's becoming a higher sulfur content in oil. In other words, same thing there. We got all the good stuff. Now we're dealing with the not so good stuff. And to refine that into gasoline, you don't get the same number of gallons out. So all of a sudden, even if you got the same number of gallons barrels out, the number of gallons that result from those barrels is significantly less. Then when you add on all the EPA restrictions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all the different state regulations, it dwindles and dwindles and dwindles, and we wind up with a shortage. And we're near a shortage now. Now, there are many people who don't believe in peak oil because they say there is more oil than you can shake a stick out there. Now, 100, 200, 300 years. The problem is you'll never be able to get it.
Exactly. Or at least not with the technology that's
yeah.
available now, or
right.
not with the technology that we foresee becoming available over the next 25 to maybe even, I mean, it's hard to look out much further than that. But,
yeah.
you know, based on what we've got now and what we've got to work with for the foreseeable future, we're not going to be able to get at a lot of this stuff. I would even go as far, and I've talked to a lot of geologists about this because it's a topic that intrigues me. You know, it's kind of like the Keynesian versus Austrian economic perspective kind of thing. The peak oil, you know, you've got people that will tell you that, well, it just regenerates under the earth, and I think that's absolute hogwash. I've never had a geologist tell me that there was one shred of scientific evidence.
I hear that. They said, oh, it's always replenishing itself. It just doesn't go away. If it doesn't, how come the United States is importing oil? I mean, we sucked it all out of it. How come it's
you know, and how come Canarel's production down there in Mexico is going down, I guess it's 7 or 8% a year now or something like that.
Right.
I'm not up to date on the statistics, but it's been diminishing
rather
rapidly. And I've never heard anybody present one shred of scientific evidence to support how exactly that whole thing happened. But I think your point is a good one, and it's not just that. I mean, it's so many of these essential commodities, and we don't think about this stuff in our daily lives. I mean, you just go throughout your house, and you look at all the things that it takes oil to get. And, you know, it's not heavy sour crude or high sulfur crude. You know, we need light, sweet crude oil to do this. And if we're going to start cracking the heavy sour crudes, it takes more BTUs. So we're getting, net on net BTUs, we're getting less right there. And then you throw in all these other factors, and you're really starting to, pour an awful lot of barrels into the black box to get a little bit of gasoline or jet fuel or whatever the case may be to get that out of there.
Right.
It's costing more and more and more, and it's costing more at every level of the stream, the production stream, whether it's getting it out of the ground, shipping it, pipelining it, refining it, and transporting it after it's pipelined and refined and all that sort of thing. It's just it's costing a little bit more at every step, and that's one of the things that's been driving that. So I don't see, as far as gas prices go, I think probably where we're at right now is probably like a new norm. Where we used to talk about getting a gallon for under a buck, now it's $2.50 is cheap.
Right.
And eventually it'll be $3 and $3.50 and $4 and $4.50, and that's the way of these things, and
what's
the way it happens.
If people's income don't keep up with the rising cost of all commodities, this is how the wealth of America gets totally drained. This is how we become a third world nation, where before we would spend basically a very small portion of our money for energy, for food and the necessities, and then the rest we went out and had a good time. When you see, we're not going to have a good time anymore, because all of our money is going to be spent just on the necessities. The petroleum industry lives and dies on what they call, EROEI, the return, energy returned on energy invested. Everything is energy. There can be oil out there, but if oil is going, if they're going to sell a gallon of gasoline at for $2.69 a gallon, and they have to build a half a billion dollar platform and maybe not get anything out of it, you're not going to get it for $2.69 a gallon, So it's all that. And if they don't think that they can sell it for any more than that, it's not going to get built. It'll stay there. The stuff will rot there.
Well, the thing, I remember a conversation I had with Zapata George, who he passed away recently. This was a while ago, when they had announced that big find down off the coast of Brazil. And I forget how many miles under the ocean it is, and so forth. And he said at the time that they basically, what they did is they drilled a billion-dollar hole in the ground, a billion bucks.
That's right.
just to get down there and figure out if there was any oil there.
Right.
That doesn't account for getting any of it over to shore. That doesn't account for all the undersea pipelining or all everything that's going to have to go into this to get this oil to a point where they can actually do something with it. $1 billion just to put a hole in the ground to try to see if there was even anything there. They've done some NMR and other testing and that kind of stuff, but really, to see where the rubber hits the road, they had to spend $1 billion. I mean, when you think about that, and then you think about, all right, is it unreasonable to ask for 50 cent a gallon gas? I mean, I think the answer becomes pretty clear. And everybody wants to pile on these oil companies right away as soon as the price of gas goes up. And I'm sure in some instances there's gouging that goes on. I mean, that's the way the world works. The government gouges, companies gouge, people gouge, everybody gouges. That's the way of the world. But people ignore that billion-dollar hole in the ground that somebody had to drill to see if there was even oil down there. Now, I don't have $1 billion. I can't do it. Somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to put capital on the line. Somebody's got to take investment and put it on the line and do this.
Right.
And that's what I think people don't get.
Yeah. Andy, I want to change the course of the conversation a little bit because there's a question I've always wanted to ask, and I keep on forgetting it. It came into my head for some reason. And that is the balance of payments deficit, where we say that China holds, $1 trillion, whatever it is, $1.2 trillion of treasuries. When we say that, do we mean the Chinese government, or just that the Chinese industry as a whole does that? I mean, in other words, the traders, within in China.
Well, basically what happens is when we... Let me walk you through a hypothetical here. They ship a widget over here, and it lands over in San Francisco or Los Angeles or wherever, and it gets trucked out to where you're at, and you buy the widget at the local store. And the widget costs, $5.
Yeah.
That $5 gets paid to the local store by you. They had to pay their supplier. Their supplier paid another supplier. And eventually, that factory or that company over in China got paid some portion of that. Maybe it was $4 that they got paid.
Right.
Now, their country, that company over there in China, they've got this $4 for this product. Let's say they got four. What they do is they take it to their bank, just like you would do here, and they swap it out for their currency. And the bank now has the $4.
Right.
And what ends up happening is it gets passed up through the ladder there until it ends up at their central bank. And what their central bank does, they send the dollars back here. They buy the bonds. So it's not... the little corporations over there, for the most part, some of them do, but I'm talking about, the majority of the time, it's the central bank over in China that ends up recycling the dollars back to us, buying the treasury bonds and holding them.
Right.
They hold the vast, vast majority of the bonds. Very few companies or corporate entities over in China actually do that because that's not what they're in business to do.
Okay.
So,
all right.
For the most part, it's the central bank.
Yeah. Are the Chinese getting a little concerned about the our quantitative easing and what's happening here economically, where I understand that the manufacturers index of some sort was not as good as they anticipated? They expected a positive negative number and they received a negative number. Can you help me out with that one? And what does China do? Do they just keep on buying out debt or what? I mean, it seems like it's a suicide to continue to buy a currency that basically has no future.
The interesting thing is, a lot of people are under this impression that what we have here is a situation where the dollar is vaporizing into this hyperinflationary scenario. And when you look at M3 right now, and there's a number of reconstructions that are done, the data is all publicly available, and you look at them, and M3 is actually contracting, and
it's been contracting
for several months now.
Right.
So what we have going on right now at a monetary level, and that's how you define this, we have a deflationary event going on right now.
Right.
We don't have an inflationary event.
Right.
So in theory, the dollar is becoming more valuable.
Right.
That's not necessarily trade. This is the weirdest thing that we've ever had from a monetary perspective, because you talk to 9 out of 10 people, and they're going to tell you that their cost of living is going up.
Right.
They're saying, I need more money this year than I needed last year to buy the things I need to live.
And they would be correct, would they not?
They would be correct.
Okay.
But if you look at the aggregate, M3, if we can rely on the inputs, which, that's neither here nor there, the inputs are telling us that there's a deflationary event going on right now.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, a record high for gold in the face of a deflationary event is pretty substantial. And I think it represents, if that actually is accurate input data, and we are experiencing a deflationary event right now, that is pretty remarkable.
Right.
Because that's not what you would expect to have happen. So the Chinese are going to look at all of this, and they obviously have better information than you and I do. So they're looking at all of these things, and they have scaled back their bond purchases, you know, according to all the data that, you know, that we're able to collect. They've not totally stopped. I think they understand that if they stop, they cut their nose off to spite their face, you know, because it would cause a crisis here similar to what happened over in Europe earlier this year, which is still ongoing, by the way. So I don't think that they're eager right at this point to just touch off a crisis, but they can use that as leverage. You know, they call it the nuclear option in the media. You know, and that's where I was talking about, I think it was when Joe was, you know, on here, we were talking about this whole idea of leverage, how we've lost our ability to lever our economy.
Right.
We can't say, hey, you know, pound sand, we're going to start producing our own products here, because they'll say, fine, we'll stop buying your bonds. You're going to have to make an instantaneous transition.
Right. Yeah.
Or they'll say, hey, fine, we're not going to ship any more products to you. And what are we doing in the 2, 3, 5 years or whatever that it takes to retool and rebuild? You know, we're kind of out of luck. So they hold the aces, and we've got a pair of deuces as far as leverage goes.
Right. Well, I, you know,
I don't know if that know if that answers your question.
The
New York survey came out, and it wasn't what everybody had hoped it would be. It wasn't what everybody thought it would be. The Philly Fed survey has been awful the past couple of times. So you've got some very real cracks in the facade of this. Manufacturing is going to lead us out of this economic malaise. I wrote an article on that about a month ago, and I got all kind of hate mail, and other people said, you know, you're absolutely right. So I mean, it was about 50-50.
Yeah.
So at least we're up to 50-50 now.
Okay, great. Well, I guess then the M3 is going down because the velocity of money is going down. People are not borrowing, and they're not creating credit with their credit cards as they used to. Is that correct, or is that something independent?
Well, actually, velocity of money is the aggregate divided by GDP. So you need the aggregate first to get the velocity.
Okay.
You've got a situation there where, you know, for the banking system is normally what creates most of the inflation in this country through the multiplier and the reserve ratios. So by them not lending, they take a dollar in and they sit on it. If they don't make $10 worth of loans, that's $10 that the money supply doesn't find.
Okay, Andy,
doesn't get it.
Yeah, we have a couple of more callers on the line. I think we can take one possibly. We have one more minute left. Caller, iSirius.
Yeah, let's throw him.
Hello, iSirius, are you on the line?
Yeah, hi, Joe. Thanks for taking my call.
Excuse me, may I interrupt? We have about 30 seconds. Could you give him a 15-second question, and he can give you a 15-second answer, because I'm going to lose the line, okay? So I just want to let you know. Thank you for calling
in. I understand the contraction of M3. Well, it really isn't a contraction. If anything, it's a slowdown, because the M3 is essentially the result of all the credit that was extended, which is money times multiplier or fraction times multiplier. So what about the $3 trillion that landed in the economy from the Fed in the last 18 fiscal months? I mean, isn't that going to end up multiplying?
Well, you take a look at the go to shadowstats.com and look, and you're looking at about a minus 3%, 4% contraction right now in M3. So that money that was dumped into the economy, it's sitting at the Fed right now, a lot of it, making 15 basis points. And they're actually going to create a plan where they can give the banks little certificates of deposit so they can pay them more interest. So it's being aggregated. It's not being lent.
5 seconds, just to cut in quickly.
Okay.
If that's the case, why is it that we're dropping against the yen and the gold is soaring to an all-time high?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, you've got an inflationary expectation, I think, and that's one of the things people aren't paying attention to at this point.
Yeah.
Or we've got bad data.
Yeah, either that or okay, Cole, I'm awfully sorry. I really wish we had more time, but we're going to just be cut off, and it's going to be, I hate to see that happen.
No problem. Joe, I'll catch you on the next show.
Okay, thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate that. We have one more caller. I'll just take... caller, you're on the air, but unfortunately we are running out of time. Thank you by the way, may I ask your first name and where you're calling from?
Yeah, this is Joe. You wanted to talk to me, Joe.
Okay, very good. Hours. Joe, I have 40 seconds to go. We're going to be cut off the air, okay, Joe? I'm going to hang up on you. I'll call you. I'll send you email, okay? Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right. Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Andy, we have about 10 seconds. I want to thank you very much for being on our show. I just wish we had more time. We always seem to run out of time. I appreciate it very, very much. Your newsletter, mytwocentsonline.com. Everyone should subscribe to it. And of course, your paid subscription service on sutton-associates.net. They should do so, and they'd be wiser for it. Andy, you will join us again, I hope, the third Wednesday of next month again.
I will do that, and I'll look forward to talking to
you. All
right.
Thank you so much, Andy. Good night.
All right. Bye now.
Boy, that's it. I guess this is the end of tonight's program. We'd like to thank Grand Shankers Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there is no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle. You feel free, liberated. Your life is in your own hands. But with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. They control the ride and your every move. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal." The government hates competition. With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.